It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Volkswagen has only one car-making factory in the United States, and that's in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
The German automaker offered to allow its plant workers to unionize, but workers at the VW factory ultimately voted against union representation.
In an industry that's historically been intertwined with unions, what does the rejection of union representation in Chattanooga mean?
Here to help us put the story in context is Jonathan Pollack. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Cynthia. I'm glad to be here.
Well, get us up to speed a little bit on what happened in Chattanooga.
Okay, so what happened in Chattanooga was essentially, as you said in the intro, that there was a unionization drive in the VW plant. And what was different about this drive than most of them is that typically what happens when workers want to unionize is there's kind of an all-out push by management to stop that from happening. There's a sort of waiting period from the different parts of the process of certifying a union to represent workers in a particular plant. And during the gaps in that process, management tends to flood the zone with required lectures or films or guest speakers or a way to scare people out of actually voting to certify the union. What happened in Chattanooga that's unusual is that Volkswagen was kind of hands-off. They said, well, we have these works councils in Germany and at our other plants around the world. We think it's a decent way to run the business. In the United States, for reasons I'll talk about in a little bit, American labor law requires workers to be represented by like a legitimate union if there's a works council in place. So VW said, okay, so have your election, do what you want to do, and we're just going to kind of sit this out. So VW did not flood the zone with anti-labor propaganda. Instead, that fell to essentially the state of Tennessee, that the governor, the senator, some of the representatives of Congress, and other like outside activists, people like Grover Norquist, versatile sort of all-weather conservative activist, got involved buying billboards, trying to talk workers out of it and so forth. So it was a huge campaign outside of the plant. And then in the end, VW workers voted not to certify the UAW, leaving the whole thing kind of in limbo. Volkswagen seems to have been kind of stumped by this decision. And they're kind of saying, well, they're sort of thinking twice about expanding their U.S. operations if they can't even run the plant the way they want to.
Why was this a significant story?
Well, it was a significant story because, like I said, there's a certain kind the sides are kind of switched up that, you know, historically in union elections, if the election's taking place in an area that doesn't have a strong labor movement, doesn't have a historically strong labor movement, then maybe the state is kind of on the sidelines. Maybe state officials are kind of commenting. But usually what happens is even state politicians and local politicians who are not favorable to unions will kind of say, well, it's the choice of the workers who work there. They kind of back out of it, and it's the employer that's mounting the big anti-labor effort. At VW, the employer was like totally positive, and it was the state, it was politicians and activists who campaigned against it and convinced workers not to certify the union.
Yeah, but so, and as you say, it's up to the workers then to vote in this matter. What was it that convinced them not to do that? I mean, were they swayed? Did they feel threatened not to vote yes? So what was at play there?
Well, this is the huge question. I mean, this is what people, what labor journalists, labor historians, labor economists, labor union staff are trying to figure out. And as near as we can come from, as near as we can figure out, there are a whole bunch of different factors that kind of come into it. Part of it is the historic, very small role of unions in the South, especially industrial unions like the UAW. I mean, to provide a little context for it, labor historians, labor economists kind of talk about unions in two main groups. You've got your trade unions, you've got your industrial unions. Trade unions represent people in a particular trade or craft. So that's plumbers, it's carpenters, it's steam fitters. Those are traditionally represented by the American Federation of Labor, a labor union that goes back to the 1880s. Industrial workers, once you get to a factory, the difference between different trades gets kind of hard to figure out. You've got people who work in a warehouse. You've got people who work on assembly lines. You've got people who are cleaning the plant, et cetera. They're all kind of working for the same employer, and they're doing things that are relatively interchangeable, don't require a great amount of skill and training in a particular craft. So industrial unionism came about in the 1930s through the Congress of Industrial Organizations, or the CIO. The AFL and CIO merged in the 1950s so that all of the unions under the CIO, like the UAW, the United Auto Workers, the union in question here, became part of the same labor federation with the Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners, steam fitters, and other trade unions. So part of the context is that this idea of industrial unionism that I talked about wasn't really present in the South. During the era that the CIO was organizing in the industrial north of the United States, in Chicago, in Milwaukee, in Janesville, all across the state of Michigan and Ohio, there wasn't that much industry in the South. Industries were beginning to move southward, beginning with textiles in the early 20th century. The textile plant owners looking at labor organization in textile factories and clothing factories in New England and New York as a way of getting around those union drives, moved their operations to the southern United States. Other factories in auto, really the expansion of auto factories in the South didn't happen until like the 1970s and 80s. It's a fairly recent phenomenon building on earlier industrial migration from the urban north to the rural South.
So was it seen then in the South as a big loss at all or any impact at all to say, no, thanks, we don't want to unionize?
Right. So from a Southern perspective, I mean, the election was relatively close. I think the vote was like 53% against, 47 in favor. So it wasn't a landslide by any stretch. There are quite a few workers in the plant who were presumably disappointed, who wanted the union to come in. They just didn't have a majority. For the majority opinion, as people are trying to figure out why a majority voted against it, part of it is just the scarcity of industrial unions in the South. There are so few Southern factories that are organized that there's no culture of unionization. There's no idea that industrial union is a thing, that if you work in a factory, it would be a union job, you'd have union protection and so forth. Beyond that vague sort of cultural lack of union connection, there's some stuff in the history of what unions have stood for. One of the hallmarks of the CIO that really distinguished it from the AFL back when they were separate federations in the 30s and 40s and early 50s was that AFL unions followed the same attitude towards segregation as the part of the country where the local was based. So if you were in a city where blacks and whites were segregated in other aspects of public life, then union locals would be segregated as well. Even in northern cities, this often happened. Cities like Cleveland, like Chicago, had segregated trade unions, one for black workers, one for white workers. The CIO, looking at factory structures, said it's ridiculous for us to discriminate. So this, among the other CIO accomplishments, the CIO was active in breaking down racial barriers in industrial employment. So when we're looking at where the CIO really kind of came to a head in the South, was through their effort beginning in 1945 with the end of World War II called Operation Dixie, where the CIO sought to organize the textile factories that had moved down there, the beginnings of the steel industry in the South in places like Birmingham, Alabama, and Richmond, Virginia. The CIO tried to organize Southern factories in industries where they had organized in the North, and they failed. They failed spectacularly because it was at that time when Jim Crow was the law of the land across the American South, it was easy for people who didn't want the union to say, well, look what the CIO has done in the North. It's amalgamation of the races, a scare term for people who are accustomed to this Jim Crow society. Factories, for that matter, in the South were predominantly white. There were relatively few black factory workers in Southern factories compared to auto plants, steel mills, paper mills, and the like in the northern United States. Factories in the North were much more integrated and had been since like the 19-teens. Southern factory workforces tended to be majority white. So they saw the CIO's whole MO as kind of a threat to the Southern way of life, and that was a big part of why they rejected Operation Dixie in the late 40s and early 50s. One of the things that's still under debate that people are trying to figure out is, was this behind the rejection of the UAW in Chattanooga in 2014? Is there a racial angle or not? Mm. Again, the journalism I've seen of it, the coverage that's come out there, is that it's not a slam dunk. It doesn't seem certain that that was a major factor. At the same time, people who are being interviewed are less and less likely to fess up to outward, you know, professing, no, absolutely, I don't want to work with people of a different race. The sentiments, if they're going to come out, they're often the sort of thing that comes out after long exchanges, and you sort of go back and interpret things and you say, wait, there's a little theme in here. Hmm. So that's one of the – it's a questionable context anyway. We're not totally sure that's what was going on.
We're talking with Jonathan Pollack. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. Auto workers in Chattanooga rejected the chance to unionize despite openness by Volkswagen to have them do so.
And we'd love to hear from you on this one. Are you surprised by their decision or not? What does it mean for the future of the United Auto Workers Union and labor in the South? You can share your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. We're taking a story out of the news and looking at its place in history with Jonathan Pollack, a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College.
Auto workers at a VW manufacturing plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, recently voted not to unionize. Is this an unusual move for labor in the South or not? If you were an auto worker here in Wisconsin and VW were to open a plant here, would you vote to unionize? Why or why not? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. John, labor unions have been under fire over recent years, and even 3 years ago today, our Capitol was on fire with protests after Scott Walker had introduced his idea for Act 10. Some politicians have worked to weaken, you know, unions in the public sphere, but in this case, we have a private company offering the opportunity for unionization. And why would politicians intervene in the private industry in this way?
Well, you're right. It's a really curious phenomenon. And what people are figuring is that there was a great deal of fear among industrialists in Tennessee and the politicians who represent them that VW would set some kind of precedent. That if there was a previously kind of unified front, that the South sort of built its brand as a region of the country in which to do business, it built its brand on cheap, ununionized labor. And if VW allowed its workers to organize, and if those workers were able to get higher pay and benefits and so forth, it would have this kind of ripple effect that the South in the years since, I'm going to say it's like the early 80s, right? I remember there were a couple of movies made about this, the really terrible Michael Keaton movie Gung Ho with a Japanese auto company in the South was kind of part of this trend. So for the last 30 years, this has been an ongoing trend. And the wage scales are kind of at a certain level across the board. If VW allowed unionization, if as part of that workers got a pay raise, this would kind of force other plants to keep pace. And the South's economic advantage, the advantage of cheaper labor that it promoted to other industries in the South and really around the world, there's a great deal of international trade in this, would possibly be in jeopardy. So I think that's where the impetus came from. That's why they saw fit to do it. Beyond, you know, on a deeper level, you know, one might argue that in the very individualist strain of American politics, this idea of the self-made man, that unions really kind of say, no, that doesn't actually work for a lot of people. That the idea of a union, and especially an industrial union, is that it kind of says, look, even if people are working jobs that don't require years of study and training, they're still entitled to some kind of decent wage. They still should have some power in negotiating the conditions under which they work and so forth. And if you allow the union in there, there are perhaps other ramifications of that, whether people take that cue, look at other workplaces, look at other areas of society, and say, wait a minute, individualism is not everything. There are other ways to go about running a state.
Hmm. Let's take a call. Jack in Belgium is on the line. Hi, Jack.
Hi. 3 points. One is, I think unions have outlived their usefulness. Most of the things that unions have fought for, the 40-hour work week and the safe working conditions and the like, are now law. Secondly, I don't think they represent the membership. You can see, like, the Michigan Teachers Union, who voted bad legally for the sex offender or whatever it was here recently, does tremendous damage to the membership. If, in fact, the membership would be polled, I doubt very much that they would agree that that would be wise use of the union's leverage. And in addition to that, the right to, you know, mandatory union dues, there's no accountability. Basically, if I were to bill you for services that you don't want, you would probably say, well, I'm not paying you. But with the union, basically with mandatory union dues, it really doesn't matter because whatever is decided, you get paid, you pay for. That's my 3 points. Thank you.
Thanks, Jack.
That's excellent. And that's, I mean, that's a classic refutation of what unions do. At the same time, I mean, I think, you know, I think from the UAW perspective, what they were arguing in Chattanooga and what's kind of a standard thing on union drives is that the 40-hour work week is kind of under attack, is that for a lot of people, that's not actually a thing. I mean, I know where I teach, the majority of my students work and many of them work more than 40 hours because they can't get enough hours at their job. They get 20 hours here, they get 20 hours there, they get 10 hours there. So while it's there, it's kind of constantly, it's being chipped away at. And what unions give people is sort of it's like a bigger power on their side of things to enforce laws that are kind of being eroded. As far as benefits in the workplace and so forth, unionized workplaces continue to have better benefit packages than people are able to negotiate on their own or purchase through other means. So while it's true that there are certainly way fewer workers organized during that time, that definitely a majority of state legislatures are kind of coming to that same conclusion. For actual people working in a particular plant, there's another side to it. As far as representing the membership. Unions are democratic organizations, and while there's certainly a long history of people who become apathetic toward their unions and allow people to remain in office long after they're really representing the workers' interests, I think it's a similar relationship between people in their union and people in their government more generally. We can talk about corruption in government, we can talk about corruption in unions, and the way you get around that is democracy, is you vote the bums out if there are people who are messing you up, if they're not representing you. And as far as dues go, the dues structures in unions are immensely complicated. This is something that unions spend a great amount of time on, the dues collected by all members, the mandatory membership, can only go to enforcing the contract. It can't be used for other things. If people opt in to donate to the union's political arm and so forth, that's their choice. But it goes to the upkeep and maintenance of the contract, to filing grievances when necessary, to hiring attorneys in the cases of people fired and so forth. So these are, I mean, again, these are longstanding arguments. These are arguments, some of the arguments that sank Operation Dixie back 60 years ago. But at the same time, there's still, you know, there's a reason for unions to exist according to their members. And while the abuses certainly take over the headlines, certainly the, you know, we can look at abuses in other fashions, abuses in religion, abuses in government, abuses in professions and so forth that really hog the spotlight.
Well, one question that I had posed to our listeners, and I'm going to toss it to you after we talk to one more listener, John, is if this issue were applied to Wisconsin, what outcomes might we see? Would we see the same thing that we saw in Chattanooga? But first, let's pose that question to Margie in Milwaukee. Margie, if this if the VW plant were to try to open in Wisconsin, would you vote for union membership?
Absolutely. And I probably would have said no 20 years ago. But to see what's happened with the relationship between business and the lower worker, it's really immoral. And I think in the past, what unions did do was give a better footing to employees to stand up against what was fair, what was right, what was safe in the workplace versus against the almighty dollar that is the push from upper management. And it's all of this happened in Tennessee really gives credibility to the arguments and the fears that came out when Walker did the Act 10 in Madison. Because
thanks, Margie. Let's give John a chance to respond here.
Yeah, I think I think Margie's point is consonant with the certainly with the hope of much of the labor movement You know, again, the Chattanooga case tells us that that a lot of workers are kind of agreeing with the first caller, perhaps more than the second one. But to get to the broader idea of what would happen in Wisconsin, you know, I gave kind of a big lecture to my students today about the danger of counterfactuals in history, and we're not totally, you know, we don't know. We're kind of making it up. But hey, it's 5:30 in the afternoon. We're on the radio. So what the heck? I think Wisconsin would have a very different experience. I mean, as the caller kind of alluded to there, the controversy over Act 10 brought a bunch of these labor issues into the spotlight for the first time in a very long time, that people really thought about them and talked about them at length. Additionally, the culture of unions in many Wisconsin cities, in Janesville, in Racine, Kenosha, Milwaukee, Green Bay, lots of paper mill towns all over the state. People had firsthand knowledge of what unions were able to do for those communities, that unionized jobs were solid jobs. They were steady. You could count on them. As we move into a post-union era, that's no longer the case. And I think workers in Wisconsin would be less likely to reject the union than their counterparts in Tennessee.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us and helping us see this story through the lens of history.
Thank you very much.
It was John Pollack, a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. He drops by every once in a while to help us put the news in context.